grapple the impact of the interaction. So this morning's the first chance I've had to sort of think through how we interacted and the things that were said. And I was just so, you know, like overwhelmed by just the this one woman in particular who said, you know, people are enslaved, and that language of just calling people slaves ends up, nope, you know, they're not born slaves.
Right.
And I already learned from work at the White Privilege Conference early on, like I always make sure I say, you know, these were children, parents, grandparents, stolen, you know, so to try to keep that humanity. But she really captured in the audience, they kept using slaves. And so now from now on, I learned, you know, so I will make sure I'm capturing people in the audience who are using that terminology, because it was powerful. And language.
Thing down here, because all I see is your neck.
Are we good?
There we go. Yeah.
I was sitting up against you.
I know. You were like, okay, Philippe, let me tell you this, what happened. Let now the other thing. That's what happens when we're in the green room. We're live, ladies and gentlemen. Back with Jacqueline Battalore, Dr. Jacqueline Battalore, author of Birth of a White Nation, professor of sociology at St. Xavier University in Chicago. Just talking about her speaking engagement last night. She had a major, massive turnout, and it was very positive. And we were just kind of in the green room sharing the power of humanity, the power of language. And it really kind of sets up what we're going to be talking about today, is dismantling white superiority in a Trump administration and using particular language we take for granted, and how subtle that is in terms of diminishing our humanity. Welcome back, Doc.
Thanks. Great to be here. Thanks, Philippe.
Well, we always have to set the precedent with the show for those who are under rocks and have not seen previous shows that you and I have done. If this is the first time you're being introduced to Dr. Jacqueline Battalore, what makes Dr. Battalore such a force of nature in this fight against racism, bigotry, white supremacy, and superiority is that she basically went back. It was by accident, in a sense, that you found these laws, and there were people who preceded you, like, you know, Theodore Allen and many others who have wrote about this, but you are the person of today, if you will, that is really helping us understand white people were created for a purpose in America, that there is no historical reference of any European in history referring to themselves as white or people as white. So this was a construct that was created only in America and for a specific reason. Let's walk through that real quick, and then we can get into our actual conversation.
Absolutely. The parts that are so important to remember are that to lay the groundwork, prior to the moment in time when this category called white people was invented, people of African descent and people of European descent in the colonies had the exact same rights as a matter of law. So that, what did that mean? It meant that a free man of African descent could vote, and they did. They could own indentured servants or slaves, and they did. Because we are so unfamiliar with a society that looks like that, mm-hmm. that sort of part of the picture is the one that people have the hardest time grasping. Mm-hmm. And especially if you look to the work of historian Edmund Morgan, who especially looks at the Virginia colony, his research, you'll see that he provides lots of evidence to show that to support the claim that persons of African descent and persons of European descent were treated the same as a matter of law. They lived the same life on the plantations, ate together, slept together. There was no hierarchy that was based upon someone being from Africa or somebody being from Europe. None at all. So that's a key part always to hold on to. So why then was this category white people invented? It was invented because there was a huge rebellion, and it threatened the 1%. And so they responded to that threat, and they wrote in communications to the legal oversight authority in London that they're going to ensure Bacon's rebellion never happens again. And how are they going to do it? They're going to deploy a divide and conquer strategy. so that the united labor force that rose up against them could never happen again. And that's where Theodore Allen's work is really important. He dug into those letters and he captured their, excuse me, their expressed intent to divide the laborers.
Wow.
And so it is after that communication and after the rebellion that we see the first use in law of a reference to a group of humanity called white people. And it happens in 1681 in colonial Maryland. And what we know is there's a whole bundle of laws that get passed. And what they did was they reorganized colonial society and they created an entirely new bottom to the society and tossed people of African descent and members of native tribes to the bottom and gave this new invented group of people called white people benefits that allowed them to rule over persons of African descent and members of native tribes. And so that's the shorthand story of the invention of white people.
And the longhand story, of course, is that's what ushered in chattel slavery, and that's what ushered in all of the what we are living with today, and why you and I are having these conversations, trying to put some context into, well, why do white people hate black people, and why do black people hate white people, and where is all of this coming from? We now know that there was a genesis. It wasn't just something that socially started per se. Obviously, there were attitudes and some levels of consciousness of them versus us in terms of color prior to that, in order for them to say, well, you know what, we're going to now make it really a law. Because I think I remember you saying that they were kind of trying to massage this earlier, like in 1640.
Right.
But it really didn't stick. They actually had a law where people of African descent could not vote, but couldn't own gunpowder or something to that effect. But they didn't really, it wasn't, you know, it was like, you know, just kind of driving past a stoplight. It wasn't something that was going to, you know.
Unenforced. It just was unenforced. A dead law.
Yeah, a dead law. So, you know, this is powerful because we're here in this new administration in the White House. And there was, you remember that movement, Occupy Wall Street?
Absolutely.
Well, Occupy Ross, I remember having some experts on to talk about the Occupy movement, and it was the first time I had even heard the term the 1%.
Yes.
Obviously, I had no historical reference to it in terms of what we're talking about right now.
I actually use that language from Occupy Wall Street. It's not from my era. It's today's version.
Absolutely. Well, you know, what's powerful about this continued ongoing conversation, Doc, is white people, quote unquote, that are walking around right now, and the children to be born are born into a duped system and a duped identity.
Yeah.
White people are in and living an identity crisis based upon what was set into law 1681, that as a result they have these special privileges and this special attitude. And you were telling me in the green room that when you were doing the speaking engagement in the audience, a lot of people were constantly saying, you know, well, when slaves was this and slaves were that. And there was a Jamaican woman that stood up and said, no, there were people who were enslaved. Because when you start using and internalizing the language of slaves as if these are no longer people, taking away their humanity, that's how easy and slippery that slope is to begin them versus us. We're superior, you're not. And this is where we are now with a lot of the language and attitude that we see in this new administration.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was really a powerful moment. I was letting you know I've had a bunch of feedback today from people who are at the talk, and most of them made reference to how powerful that was for them. Because it's so common, right? It's just common to use the terminology slave, but what are we doing, right, when we just participate without seeing what we're doing? And it made me think of other really common terminology, like I'm just an American and you're an African American.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like I always loved when Whoopi Goldberg was like, I'm an American. And she took a lot of heat from it, from the African-American community.
Mm-hmm.
But,
mm-hmm.
but she was, I think, really contesting that.
Because there is a difference between an American and an African American.
It applies white.
Exactly.
It was created from its founding via naturalization law. So, yeah. but to resist it in her language and her claim for herself, I loved that. You know, I loved that. That
very powerful and very enlightened woman. Very, very enlightened woman. I would not be surprised if she has read your books and all and know of that level of history, which is interesting to bring up. You know, previous President Barack Obama had a Juris Doctorate in international law.
Right.
He had to know. He had to know, wouldn't you? I mean, you're a lawyer. But that wasn't your specialty.
You
kind of accidentally found out about it as you were looking back. You went home and something was bothering you, nagging you. You can tell that story. But what do you think is? Do the presidents know this?
No.
Well, I guess this one does it because he thinks Frederick Douglass is still alive.
No. And I don't think Barack Obama knew it. Because here's the thing. Law school is a Juris Doctorate. And nobody really specializes. What it usually means is you got to take a couple of upper level law classes in a particular area. For example, international law. But you don't specialize in law school. It's just a law degree. So
interesting.
So to me, that suggests that he didn't know this. Very few people know this, Philippe. Your listenership are probably among the 1% in that regard. Truly. I know that may sound shocking to people, and I also think we kind of like this conspiracy theory. That, you know, they really know and they're hiding it. I think it simply doesn't hold up.
Really? Well, that's interesting. That's very powerful because considering, you know, what those laws meant and what they mean even today and the historical relevance of that. You think there's a lot of legislators and politicians in high office that don't know about
the
invention of white people?
They don't know.
Really?
Absolutely.
Well, we need to go and start a whole. We need to protest, get some flags and stuff.
Why I'm here with you so regularly. Like we look here's
because we've never. Now you and I have never had this conversation.
Yeah, before. No. But
and I'm shocked. I'm gonna be. I'm interested to hear from you guys out there, your thoughts because I'm saying, they gotta know.
Let me ask your listeners this. Here, and you know, in this new book that I keep saying I'm writing, and I really am.
Yeah, eventually it will be out.
So there was this young man who was, I believe he was a first-year student at Princeton. And a couple of years ago, he wrote this op-ed in the Princeton paper saying he was really angry about hearing check your privilege. He kept hearing that and hearing it and hearing it. Mm-hmm. And he was like, I don't have any privilege, and I don't know what you're talking about. And my family was Jewish, and half of them were slaughtered, and my grandparents were lucky enough to be allowed into this amazing nation where they could work hard and succeed. You know the story, okay? So, and he was picked up by Fox News, and all the really conservative commentarians loved him. And so when a Google journalist called me and asked for my thoughts on it, it really drove home this point. Our K-12 education does not give us the information that we need to understand this history that I've been just trying to get out there. Mm-hmm. Right? Because here he is at an elite Ivy League school, and he has no clue that the only reason his parents could become naturalized citizens in the 1940s was because they were white, right?
No other reason.
No, and why would he? Did you learn it in school? I didn't learn it. No. Nobody, you know, and I didn't learn it in graduate school, and I didn't learn it in law school.
Where I think, Doc, the conspiracy theory comes from. Who's hiding this information? Why is it hidden? Why is this history hidden?
Well, you have to, I mean, here's what's so important for us to understand. Is that our we are all, including us in this moment, we are so limited in how we can make sense of things by mm-hmm. our conceptual frameworks. Mm-hmm. And my ability to identify that when I was looking through those laws and white people weren't there then and they were there at this moment, I bet thousands, hundreds of thousands of people may have seen that. But nobody said, wait a minute, maybe white people were invented, right? And why did I get to have that thought? Because social constructionist theory had given me this light bulb, this analytical tool to make sense of it in that way. And that very much grew out of social analysis within the field of sociology. Berger and Luckman are probably the major sources of that. They wrote The Social Construction of Reality. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
I don't think there's this intentional hiding part. I think that people are living out these racial biases that we inherited from way long ago and have fed and continue to regularly feed. I'm not trying to suggest that doesn't go on, because of course it does. We have these different categories of people who are treated so dramatically differently if we didn't continuously feed and support them. So that's a given. But in terms of intentionally hiding, I don't think that's the case. I think you're giving people too much intellectual credit, to be honest.
I think that when you're looking at what you have uncovered by accident, if you will, and even what Theodore Allen and
Morgan Edmund,
and there's also a lady too. There's a woman who has done this work too. I don't know if she's still with us, that you had mentioned in previous shows. It's something that could possibly threaten the status quo of government.
Absolutely.
Right? So sometimes just knowledge is equivalent to a Bacon's Rebellion.
Absolutely.
So waking up an awareness, like we had Debbie Allen on the show, Waking Up White. We're going to have her come on.
Debbie Irving.
We're going to have her come on with you to talk about writing a white biography. But, you know, when you wake up white, which is interesting, and it's like, if enough people wake up white, it shifts the entire functioning of America. It shifts the military. It shifts economics. It shifts everything.
And because because everything was built on white superiority and hiding it as white superiority. Yeah. There's a reason so many people have a hard time saying white privilege or acknowledging having it, right? Because the work of institutionalized white superiority is keeping it just the way it is.
Right. And we see that in this current administration.
In an extreme fashion.
Yeah. Talk to us a little bit about, you know, as a white woman looking at these white men, what you experience when you see that.
Let me share with you what I'm most excited about.
PG-rated. I'm just kidding. No, go ahead.
So here's what I think we're seeing evidence of, and I have a spark of excitement about it, which may be shocking to your viewers. But it wouldn't have happened, for example, if Hillary Clinton had been elected or Bernie Sanders. We would have had different dynamics. Would have been underway.
Totally different conversations.
Yeah. So, but what this moment I think is giving rise to is a couple key things. One, something that we experienced and saw with the Women's March, and mm-hmm. that is that people, for a variety of different reasons, right? People had different sort of agendas and different reasons for being at that Women's March. Mm-hmm. Lots of people there were there to say, women are fully human. Women have rights. They're human rights. And, you know, so there was that contingent. There was LGBT, QIA people there saying, hey, look, we're human too, and we deserve rights in this country.
For the sake of edification, QIA?
excuse me, QI, queer and intersexed people.
Oh, okay. I've never even heard the term intersexed. Okay.
My apologies. Yeah, the A is I'm part of a group at my daughter's school, and we're an affinity group called LGBTQIA, and the A is for people who are alliance, you know, in alliance.
Okay.
There is no A category. Okay. I suppose it could be asexual, I suppose.
Okay. Yeah, right. Okay.
My apologies. And, you know, there were people there to challenge the Islamophobia out there. Mm-hmm. There were people. So, and Black Lives Matter signs were everywhere, and pro-Mexican, undocumented people and how valuable they are to this economy and to the community. So there were more than that, but you get a sense of a variety of voices. And so at that march, there was a bringing together of these otherwise often disparate groups. And you could feel we are far more together, right? We felt that pre-Bacon's Rebellion unity. You could feel it. We were like, we have so much more that ties us together than pushes us apart.
Right.
And so that is something that this moment and these white men and their ideological assertions that we're going to see in more and more policies, that wouldn't happen. Wouldn't have happened but for this group of white men. Mm-hmm. So that's a really, it holds incredible potential, right? Because we can have a Bacon's Rebellion when we're together, you know, mm-hmm. when we're apart, that it doesn't work.
Right.
Right? So that
Bacon Rebellion conversations.
Yes. So wow, we have some real potential there. The other thing that I see happening is that which is more of a labor movement, at least the evidence I know of is coming mm-hmm. from the labor movement, and that is workers are seeing that things are so damn bad for them, and the prospects of their economic improvement are diminishing. So they're like, why not take action? Like, what do we have to lose? Things have gotten so bad that, okay, so I'm at threat of losing my job, but you know what? I can't pay my bills as it is now.
Well, you know, you bring up a good point. So I'm going to be devil's advocate. And that is, sure. Okay, so what if we have another, not literal Bacon's Rebellion, but we have a rebellion from that a part of America that says enough is enough. What's stopping them from kind of, if you will, rolling back and these anti-miscegenation laws and starting to implement some of those anti-miscegenation laws again, because are we looking at the extinction of the African-American? Are we looking at a post-slavery society that's going to protect this 1% again?
Right. I just don't see it happening. I mean, maybe I'm too in my urban areas, but let's not forget the urban areas, when you add us all up, we're the majority, you know? So I just don't see, I don't see the masses in America allowing that to happen. Maybe the laws would get passed and they can't stop them because of who's in control of the legislative power, but I don't see people complying. Or well, willing to comply, just like we have this movement to protect, right? We have an Underground Railroad movement taking shape today to try to help ensure that undocumented people in this country who are at threat of being deported are finding protection and a path to safe places. Mm-hmm. It's happening mm-hmm. as we speak. So that's the kind of resistance that I mean. I mean, mm-hmm. I just see if those... clearly the ability to block the lawmakers, especially at the federal level, from doing this, I don't think our ability is there unless we communicate in a convincing way to them and they feel threatened in their power positions. You know, then maybe we could stop that. But because they are because so many Republicans in particular are just caving to the ideological platform of Trump and Bannon and the others who are really running the White House, I don't know how much power we have there, but we have tremendous power on the ground.
So let me put my hardcore journalist hat on and ask you, are you altruistic or are you in denial?
Well, you know, I think the fact of the matter is that only history will tell where I'm at. I wish I could remember the researcher's name.
I don't to interrupt you, but I remember talking to Dr. Joy DeGruy, who did post-traumatic snake syndrome. She's the most brilliant woman in the world. And we had a meeting, we had coffee, and she was saying, you know, Philippe, I bet you there were people who said when Hitler was trying to roll out his agenda, a lot of people say, oh, there's no way nobody's going to go for that. That just can't happen. Well, you know, so I'm hearing you and I'm with you.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, are we looking at a new extinction protocol for population control over the African American?
I think what we're seeing is a knee-jerk reaction on the part of some numbers of white people who are consciously or unconsciously threatened by the fact that they are numerically going to be the minority in a year or two.
Okay, so we kind of saw that with the historical turnout of white people voting that had never voted before.
Right.
We didn't even know they existed. We're like, where are these white people? It's like white people in a, this is like all of them were in a crate somewhere in a carton just in case. Oh, we got to vote. Come on out. Let's go out. We can't have this. When we look at this threat to whiteness, how do we evolve out of that? Because it was a process for you.
Oh, absolutely.
And still is, actually.
Absolutely. On the path.
Yeah. You're on the road again. So you're on the road to raising your level of consciousness up. Well, hell, everybody ain't Dr. Jacqueline Battalora.
Right.
All white people are not equal in one sense. And so this is where I think you look at the Dylann Roofs and all of these people that are constantly trying to talk about starting a race war. You look at the KKK, you look at all of the militias.
The groups have doubled, I guess, in the last 2 years.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I think Southern Poverty Law Center's work is so important right now.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, I mean, so a part of this conversation, we just have to keep it real. And that's why I'm saying, are we altruistic? Are we in denial?
Yeah.
Is this something that we just are going to evolve out of, or is there something that we actually can and do, or that we should begin doing?
Yeah, well, I think that we have to keep asking the question. The question is important. And I think, you know, one of the things that I'm seeing at the university is that people are making these parallels between policies of the Trump administration and the rise of Hitler and Nazi Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, people are talking about it, and there's concern that we in fact are heading in that direction. And I think we have to keep posing the question and keep being vigilant about what's happening next and where we're going to stand.
As I know you got to go, we're going to close out this conversation. But one of the things that I think is pivotal for your work that when people, so you know, you look at all of these white supremacy groups.
Yes.
It's all based on a lie.
Yes.
And they don't know this lie.
That's right.
They don't know. They think that, wait a minute, we're genetically superior, mm-hmm, because we're white, and you people were slaves and you just happened to get freed. But that doesn't change
why you were enslaved.
Right, right, exactly. So these white superiority groups, these terrorist groups that are in America, once they find out that they were duped too, because the diabolical genius of these laws for the 1% protected them from both parties. It created the middle class. It gave poor whites, uneducated whites, a sense of purpose.
That's right.
And this is what they are, particularly the KKK, because it's not a lot of, I don't believe there's a lot of college professors that are in the KKK. There might be, but the majority, let's keep it real, is the, if you will, such, if there is such a term, a disadvantaged white person, is poor whites, poor uneducated whites.
Yeah.
If they understood that they were and still are being duped, and this 1% that we see that's still in power created these laws so they can get away basically with murder and live a life that most of us will never fathom or understand. If you can get that level of information, because if you just come to them with civil rights jargon talk, not going to happen.
No.
It hasn't happened.
That's right.
But if you look at it and say, wait a minute, here's the law. Here, because you the course that you created, the free e-course that you created, that people can go to the link down here at the bottom of the YouTube video. There you have photos of the actual law. So this is not a conspiracy theory conversation. This is not hyperbole. This is not hypothesis. This is law. This is real. Here are the laws, anti-miscegenation. Here's how they. And here's why. And then, of course, in the book, you really, you know, unpack the whole thing, Birth of a White Nation. What happens is it's not even a knee jerk. It's just a punch from Mike Tyson. It's a punch from Mike Tyson in the gut when you read it and it's there and you can't deny it. It's something that is, it's, you know, Nishi says, once the mind has been expanded, it can't go back to the way it once was. That's what your work does. That's what you do. And that has positive consequences and also negative consequences.
Threatening.
I think more positive than the negative over the period of time. Yeah. But there are going to be some people that are going to look and say, I can't even believe that.
Yeah.
But the majority will say, really? Like I did. I'm
right.
What? Mm-hmm. Because you just can't explain white privilege, white fragility, white superiority, white supremacy, institutionalized racism. You can't explain it in a civil rights context.
No.
It just doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Not taking away from the civil rights movement and the necessity of it, which is why we're going to have you come on with Dr. Robin DiAngelo, and we're going to talk about white fragility, white privilege, where all of this came from and where we are now. It's going to be it's going to be historical because it's never been done before. And I couldn't imagine two more perfect people to meld together to have this conversation, because here's the historical relevance and reference of how and why we are here and why people exist. Mm-hmm. Now, here is what happens as a result of that. Here's white privilege and here's white fragility. When white people sense or are in a situation of racial stress in terms of conversation, they become fragile in a sense, and there's a whole list of various different behaviors and attitudes and characteristics and traits that manifest and unfold as a result. Dr. Robin DiAngelo took white privilege and took it to the next level in white fragility, and here we are. So we're going to unpack this. That being... I just went on a soliloquy. You can chime in anytime you want, Doc, on my show, right? But if you could, before we leave, can you give us your thoughts on how white people that you know have, when they hear what you have to say for the first time? Is it a deer in the headlights? Because sometimes, you know, the regular civil rights, you know, conversation is just deer in the headlights for most white people. But do you get that, or do you get the aha moment, or what do white people see or do or hear when they hear you speak to them?
I have, and it cuts across white and non-white people, two predominant responses that happen together or bouncing back and forth.
Okay.
One is one of anger because the history is horrific, because the consequences are so damaging and so cruel. Anger that they've never learned it before, that the U.S. history that we get in K through 12 and frankly in most undergrad classes fails to capture institutionalized white superiority. So there's the anger that comes from that. And the other part that gets expressed sometimes from the same person at different moments mm-hmm. is a sense of almost a giddiness at the relief that so many people have, because once you understand this history, mm-hmm. the now makes so much sense.
It puts it in, oh my God, it was that way for me too.
Black men are getting shot and killed all the time by law enforcement. This is such important information to help us make sense of why the things that are happening in these racially disparate ways are happening. And each of us has a role in that. So people, I mean, if you saw the messages that I have today on my email and text from different people who were there last night, you go from one raging, you know, a raging woman, you know, saying, oh, this, and how did that happen? And why didn't we know this? And we have got to get this in our history books. And to the other one saying, oh my God, I'm still processing this, and it's, why didn't we get this, and how, I'm just so relieved to understand how our society today is working. And most of the people that were there last night were within a school district and have elementary or middle school children, mm-hmm. and so for them it was a relief to help make sense of the disparities that persist within our education system, despite such good intentioned people, you know, like when right. you understand the systemic dimensions, you're yes. like, okay, like now we can do something, because now we really get, you know, the yeah. roots of why.
We have unequivocal historical context.
Yeah. So those are the predominant ranges of responses that I get.
Fascinating. Fascinating. That is interesting. So it's just, so I forgot what it was, some show. Where, you know, your information is like when white people's heads began to explode. Mm-hmm. They just blow up. It's like, oh my God, this is just way too much. Mm-hmm. But it's just powerful, unequivocal information. It is the stoplight of stoplights.
Yeah, it for what I hope for most white people in particular is that it's that first step of commitment to being on the path.
Yeah.
You know?
Because you have to acknowledge white privilege, you have to acknowledge white superiority as some premise. You know, you can be in denial of it, and you can say, well, my family came over and they were immigrants.
And your family arrived yesterday.
Right.
White privilege, I still get it when I go to the bank. I'm still, when I drive and a police car pulls me over, I don't worry that I'm pulled over because of my race.
Yep.
I mean, I don't care when your family came. It doesn't matter. It's built in and it continues to flow out.
This is great. All right. Well, Doc, I can't appreciate you enough.
Thank you so much.
You just totally rock.
With Robin DiAngelo.
Yep. On the 10th, ladies and gentlemen, March 10th, Robin DiAngelo and Battle Laura. It's going to be a battle.
All right.
White privilege versus white fragility. No ear biting and none of that. Okay.
All
just
right.
So you know, keep
we'll
it
behave.
Going. Okay, you guys behave. Stick around with me in the green room as we sign off. Take care, everybody. Hey, share some comments. Share this. Tell us what you think about this conversation. Were we on point? Where can we go? What do you feel?